We're talking now with Ben Olson. He is publisher and editor-in-chief of Sandpoint Reader. And we're going to be doing what has become kind of a tradition, our annual year in review. We're looking at local stories that were important, made a difference. Ben, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And we were going to have some other journalists. I invited some folks from the Daily Bee. They couldn't make it. Lindsay Kaber, your news editor, was going to be on board. She came up sick. So it's just you and me, Ben, figuring out what were the stories of the year.
Yes, and we'll do our best, I'm sure.
And we'll miss some, I'm sure. But with that, we decided we're going to kind of go back and forth here. And why don't you pull out what you thought was, you know, this one of the top stories of the year?
I think it's hard to say, you know, top stories, top five, top ten. But I think a story that's interesting is one that we kind of began 2022 with, and we actually ended 2022 with, which is this tort claim that was filed against the Bonner County Commissioners by Scott Bauer, who's the deputy prosecutor. It's an interesting story. We first wrote about it in January of 2022, and there was just an update recently last week in the Reader about it. But it kind of shows a little bit of the infighting that's going on in the county. You have factions that have developed, and you know, you have outgoing Commissioner Dan McDonald, who has his own kind of factions going, and then you have Scott Bauer, who happens to be the son-in-law of the county sheriff, Darrell Wheeler. And so that story to me, it seems like one that kind of piggybacks onto other stories, because there's a lot going on in the county right now. Some of it behind closed doors, some of it that's getting out into the press. But that one was interesting to me just because of the bookend nature of it. You know, as I was going back through our files, I thought it was interesting to start and end a year with basically the same story.
And the claim is?
The claim mostly is that Bauer claimed that there's a malicious defamation by Commissioners McDonald and Jeff Connolly. Bauer states that they spread claims that he illegally hacked into the commissioner's email accounts with county computers. It's a strange story, and I'm not pretending to understand all of it yet, because we only have what's been released to the press and in public records. But it's one that we're going to see in 2023 probably come to a conclusion one way or another, whether it's settled or there's a judgment one way or another. But I think it's interesting, outgoing Commissioner Dan McDonald, you know, he's done after the end of the year. It's going to follow him into that at some point. So it's going to be interesting. We're going to follow up on it as the news breaks on that. But, you know, it's one that kind of raised our eyebrows for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you already intimated, these stories kind of bleed over into each other. And one of the things that definitely took up a lot of mind share and a lot of newspaper headlines this year were the elections. We had the primary elections in the spring, and then, of course, the general election in November. And it was a case in which we saw a lot of division within the Republicans, specifically because in our county, as we all know, the race for a lot of our county seats and even state seats are decided in the primary. So we had a contentious primary, and probably the biggest story there was Scott Herndon defeating Jim Woodward for the state Senate seat for District 1. Mark Sauter won an open seat. Sage Dixon, who is a conservative Republican by any measure, was held off an even more conservative, Todd Engle, mm-hmm. who was going for his seat. And it just kind of highlighted a lot of the division that's going on, not just within the Republican Party, obviously within the Republican Party, but kind of the hardening of political division in our county as well as the whole country.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a kind of a bellwether that shows how the Republican Party in Idaho specifically is moving its goalposts a little bit to the right. And it is, like you said, the primary is where all of this is decided. You can still have an upset on the general. There can be surprises here and there. But for the most part, the Idaho Republican Party has set up a system in which if you don't win the primary, you know, you are pretty much out of the running. Mm-hmm. And so that is really interesting. It was a hell of an election case or election year. Statewide, I think the referendum, you know, kind of the Idaho Freedom Foundation picks like, you know, Janice McGeehan, Priscilla Giddings, a lot of the far right candidates that presented challenges to more of the moderate middle of the Republican Party. A lot of them largely failed and lost their races. You know, Raul Labrador
was the only more extreme conservative that won statewide office. Yeah.
So I think it's an interesting case where the statewide the up ticket state races showed that the line was holding, whereas a lot of the down ballot races, the senator and representative races throughout the districts in Idaho, they sent, I think, something like 19 new members to the Idaho, or they're sending 19 new members to the Idaho House and Senate. And it's going to be an interesting year because of that. The makeup of our Congress now in Idaho is very different. It's a little bit more to the right than it has been in the past. And anybody that's followed Idaho politics know that it's, you know, it's been skewing right since the early 90s.
And there's going to be a lot more close votes, probably contentious votes on a variety of issues in this upcoming session, which kicks off in just a couple weeks now. I think January 9th is the start of the new legislative session.
Yeah.
A couple of other things on the election that the final tally was at 65.2% of the registered voters in the county cast a ballot, which was higher statewide. The rate was 56.8, and both of those numbers are really quite high for a year where the presidential office is not on the ballot. So there was a lot of interest that got provoked in this election, which is good. People got engaged that way.
Yeah.
And then locally, one of the other things that got decided in the election was there was a tourist tax proposed for lodging in Sandpoint. And that won. It took, a 60% majority to win. It won. And there was also a constitutional amendment that was proposed and won. So it was a big year for elections.
Yeah, that amendment is also going to be one that I personally think that constitutional amendment that won, that is going to put a toe in the door for having more of a full-time legislature in Idaho.
Yeah, and that amendment allows the legislature to call itself into session. Currently, only the governor can call the legislature into session. So it was kind of an outgrowth of unhappiness by some of the legislators over the way the pandemic was handled and the governor having the executive authority that he has.
Yeah.
So it does set us on the course. Utah had a similar deal a few years ago. They voted for allowing the legislature to call themselves into session. And by golly, they do. So
yeah.
That ends up costing taxpayers every time those legislators go down there to have a session on things that may or may not need to be dealt with outside of a regular session, and could even lead us eventually, like you said, to a full-time legislature, which
seems to be at odds with what the normal, you know, Idaho voter would think. Would, you know, I feel like we are proud of our citizen legislature, and I think that having a full-time politician as your representative or senator, I think that's kind of anathema to what the Idaho system of government is all about, which is like, you're one of us, you're speaking for us. And a lot of folks are not into the whole idea of having a full-time elected representative, you know, in Boise at all times. And it's more money. It's you get more entrenched politicians that way. And
people are less in touch when they don't have another day job.
Yes.
That puts them in touch with what, you know, people are really experiencing out there. So we'll see. And that would probably be years down the road. But that constitutional amendment does kind of point that direction eventually.
Mm-hmm.
All right. What's another one on your list, Ben?
You know, going back to county matters, there were a lot of growth and land use issues throughout the year. It's it's almost impossible to separate them all out. There have been so many developments and just county-wide land use debates, whether it be the Camp Bay Road vacation or the many developments, or you know, things like the ice rink by the Bonner County Sheriff's Office. It was a year defined on growth issues. You know, growing pains would be a great way to describe a lot of the county stories. Speaking of the Camp Bay Road vacation, that's another story that's kind of been on our news page over the last year or so. And, you know, in February, the commissioners denied the road vacation, which, you know, simply put, a road vacation means that the road is no longer public access. It's deemed access to the development for their purposes, in very layman's terms. You know, they actually had multiple go-arounds with this issue. They kicked it back to the Bonner County Planning and Zoning. It got kicked back to the commissioners. It's one of those kind of stories that went all over the place. And eventually, it culminated in a third hearing just a week or two ago, where the commissioners approved the road vacation after the developer, M3, promised to build a trail, a half-mile trail, to give a 50-foot access to the lake. There are still proponents for keeping that access public that are going to fight this. The Arns are definitely forefront among those. So it's not the last we're going to hear of this story, but I think it's a big blow for those who wanted to keep public access to Camp Bay. And so just that story alone, I mean, that's probably been covered on our news pages 5 or 6 times throughout 2022.
Yeah. And it was in it just standalone. It was a big issue, but, it's part of that larger whole thing of, you know, feeling these growth pains, which isn't going to go away because we are growing at a big rate here. And as you mentioned, there are a whole bunch of stories that would fit into that. Proposed marina at Trestle Creek has mm-hmm. been contested. There have been rezones in Dufort and Sully Valley that have been contested, and it does seem like even go back further than that, the county split the planning and zoning commission into two different commissions, a planning commission and a zoning commission, which is a little unusual, but it allows them to. The zoning commission to approve these minor land divisions, which in many cases seem to be kind of flying in the face of what the comprehensive plan says the intent is in our county development. So the other part of this is the comprehensive plan is being rewritten by the county and the city at the same time is redoing theirs. So it's a big time for citizens that want to get engaged in this to be paying attention to you know, what's being planned with the comprehensive plan and not only monitoring it, but putting in their own 2 cents on how they think the county should be developing. There are a couple of citizen groups that have popped up that are really got this issue front and center. One of them right in the name, Keep Bonner County Rural. Mm-hmm. that's a group that wants to try to maintain the rural quality of our county through planning and zoning. And then Project 7B has been active in these kind of growth-oriented issues and also in the whole question of vacating Camp Bay Road. So,
yeah, it's a very intriguing period of time that we're in right now in Bonner County, because it's the post-COVID, you know, sorting out all of the rocks to make it, you know, make it to figure out how we're going to manage this growth, because we got that huge influx of population and now we're almost just kind of stacking our chips and rocks and figuring out how we're going to fit it all. And so right now we have a little bit more of that growing pains mentality where, you know, some parts of the county, some members of the, or some citizens of the county want to keep things rural, and you know, the other parts of the county want to keep building as much as they can. You know, somewhere in between, a lot of Bonner County residents lie, where they understand that there's a need for growth, but it should be managed a certain way. So we're going to see continued infighting on that story, probably for years to come. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no end in sight there. So let's see. Out of so many big stories to talk about, I would probably push forward weather and fire season. It's now become basically a feature of our summers. We're going to have fires, and the fires are going to put up a bunch of smoke. We seemed like we were getting away with it this year. We went all the way through August without any big fires happening, and then end of August, early September, some fires took off, specifically the Kootenai River Complex, which is north of us. It was in the Selkirk Mountains, but also it was up Katka. There was fires up there too, putting a lot of smoke up in the air, aside from, you know, destroying a lot of timberland. The impact we see around here is this nasty, rotten smoke.
Yeah, it's our high season, and yeah. I have talked to so many people especially during the smoke periods, but so many people who are starting to reorganize their idea of when they leave town for vacation, where they go. You know, it used to be a lot of people would, you know, get out in the wintertime or in the, you know, the mucky springtime when it's all mud season. They'd want to vamoose from Sandpoint and go somewhere warm. And now I hear more and more people talking about, you know what, I just want to leave for late August and come back in mid-September for my vacation. Which is crazy to me, because that's when everybody wants
to
be here.
It's so sweet around here when the air is clear. Yeah. It's like the nicest time of year, really.
And you can never plan for it. You can never, even if there's no fires in North Idaho, you could have a huge complex up in BC or Alberta.
That's right. They had that a few years ago. Yeah. Weren't any local fires, but we were getting blanketed by smoke from Canada. So it's a regional issue. I mean, it's more than that. It's probably, no doubt it is related to some forest management practices, but also, our summers are warmer and drier, and it's part of the whole climate change that we're seeing, and that's how we're gonna, you know, pay our chit for the whole thing that's going on with the global climate change.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's what, you know, a lot of people that move here think they move here because there's no natural disasters in Idaho. There's no tornadoes or hurricanes or
earthquakes.
And you say, well, you're forgetting one major major natural disaster that hits us every year, and that's wildfire season.
Yeah.
Even if it's not close, we're going to endure the smoke of it. And I've talked to several people who have actually moved away just because of the smoke. I mean, for one example, Captain Bill Collier, you know, he's an author and veteran helicopter pilot, combat helicopter pilot in Vietnam War. Used to write for The Reader, writes a lot. He still writes a lot, but he had to move away with his wife.
He moved to the Puget Sound area, and that does get better air, but not 100% of the time. I mean, even Portland, which was never troubled by this in the past, gets nailed by smoke. Almost anywhere in the Northwest, actually, almost anywhere in the West now.
Yeah.
All up in California, into Colorado. It's a big thing that's not going to go away.
Yeah, we're going to see it happen more and more, and we just have to find out a way to mitigate the outcome as much as possible.
All right, what's your next story, Ben?
You know, I think a couple of good stories to talk about are some of our local nonprofits and organizations that have made some good strides this year. Kinnexu Land Trust, they secured an agreement to purchase the Pine Street Sledding Hill, which is a historic hill. I mean, even before Schweitzer was open, people were skiing on that hill.
They had a rope tow there at one time.
Yeah. It's just one of those like heartwarming stories that, it could have been bought by a developer to build five houses, or it could be, you know, bought by this organization, Kinnexu Land Trust, which is tasked with providing Bonner County residents with amazing opportunities like the Pine Street Woods to recreate. And so that was a great thing. And another thing was the Panda Theater. They, you know, earlier in the year, they announced they were considering selling the little theater after some back and forth with a lot of their members and the board. They decided to keep the little theater building. and shortly after announced their Century Fund fundraising campaign, which thanks to Ting Internet, they're matching up to
$200,000 in individual donations.
And so that alone, I mean, that is an amazing campaign that is going to bring so much money into the Panda Theater, and it's already brought over 270.
It's actually right now. As of today, I happen to be on that fundraising committee, so it's at $236,000 so far.
Wow!
And there's another. There's some more that's. Actually, we have some grants that are in play right now that we hope is going to push it over the first year fundraising goal of $273,000. But yeah, no question. Big things that our nonprofit organizations are trying to do that they're on such a larger scale than what we used to try to do before.
Yeah.
And there's been that trend. I mean, nonprofit groups have done some big things. Ponderay Bay Trail, Friends of Ponderay Bay Trail, it's probably been, 8 to 10 years ago now, but they did a big campaign to raise the money to acquire some key parts of that and help the communities, the cities of Ponderay and Sandpoint also buy parts of that trail. And it took almost 2 miles of our lakefront, and it set it aside as to be undeveloped. What the Kinnickson Land Trust has done with Pine Street Woods is amazing. That was just 3 years ago. They concluded a campaign to raise $2.1 million to acquire that. And now, of course, they're trying to raise that same amount again to get this old sled hill there. But it's testament to, I think, a couple things here. One is that we're realizing that with growth, we do have to protect some of these things right now that are going to be lost if we don't act proactively now. And I think maybe a bigger vision of, what is possible. I remember I was actually working at the Bonner County Daily Bee way back when the Panada was acquired the first time, in that case, we were trying to raise, I think, $250,000. It seemed like a huge sum then. and it actually only worked because we got we raised $40,000 to raise the down payment. Mm-hmm. And then a bank, which is not always it's an easy thing to get a bank to carry a note on something like that that's being put together by a brand new nonprofit organization. A bank, Panhandle State Bank specifically, did agree to carry the note on that until it could be paid off, and it was actually paid off ahead of time, the mortgage of the theater. So now it is a true community-owned theater, and it's just a testament to what can be accomplished outside of government and taxes.
Yeah,
right.
And I think it also shows the interest of the people who live here, where they want this land to be open to all. They want to have recreational possibilities. That's why they move here. That's why people still live here after growing up here. I know I wouldn't live here if there was a plain desert outside of Sandpoint. I need the mountains and the woods and the rivers and the lakes. It fills my soul, and I think it fills a lot of other people's souls. And so that just shows that people will put their money to support that idea of having a place that's carved aside, and how important of a time it is right now to carve some space aside,
to grab those last remaining pieces of undeveloped land that will go into intensive development. Look what happened with the University of Idaho property.
Yeah,
there was a golden opportunity, in my opinion, for the city to do something much more than just. It wasn't the city, of course. It was the University of Idaho that decided to sell it. But the city did have
dragged their feet.
Some recourse to be much more proactive and step up as our community leadership to do some different things. It could have included housing there. Mm-hmm. It included affordable housing, because the housing that's going up there is definitely going to be out of the reach of most average wage earners here. And they could have also had more public space retained than the way it's being developed now, which bleeds over into a whole question of housing.
Yeah.
Another big story during the course of the year was coming to grips with the fact that housing is in high demand, and that's basically driving the cost of housing up to where it's becoming untenable for locals based on the wage scale that we have with our local businesses to find housing and be our workforce here.
Yeah, I would argue that that's probably boots on the ground. That's probably the most important story to most people in Sandpoint. It's hard to cover because it's a hydra that has so many arms out. But housing, just that general issue of growth in housing, has a lot of people worried. It has a lot of people fearful, paranoid about getting kicked out of their rentals. You know, I've spoken with dozens of people who were evicted from their long-term rentals, or their price or their rent went up, you know, two or threefold. And that's tough when wages are not going up to match it, and when inflation's also counteracting that. Having to cover double or triple what your rent was without having anything to support that with your payroll or anything else, that's a disaster for a lot of people. And I've known several people that have had to move away because of that.
I will say, I think we're at a kind of a turning point right now, because there is a lot of housing that's being built now. There's a lot of units under development. I don't have that number, but I know it's over 1,000.
Yeah.
You know, as those come on the market, that should ease and make the, you know, market forces are what really drive this. It's hard to get beyond market forces. But if there's a surplus of housing, that's going to bring the cost of housing down. And then we have some developments by intention designed for affordable housing. Culver's Crossing is one of those, yep. Which is up across from the old UI property there. And then Kootenai Land Trust, which you mentioned earlier in relationship to the Sledding Hill, they're moving towards creating a community housing trust and using their nonprofit organization to really address community housing needs. And what they could do is take away a lot of the cost of the land, right? If they find land that could be dedicated to community affordable housing. The way they would work it is it's more complicated than we get into here, but they could basically offset the cost of the land so that somebody that's buying some a housing unit, might be a duplex, might be a standalone house, wouldn't have to bear all that cost of the land. They're paying more just for the construction,
right?
And then the property, when it's they live there long enough, they own it all. But if they sell early, then they don't see a big profit. So that tamps down the speculation that goes on with a lot of our housing here. So it is maybe I don't know if 2023 will be the year, but maybe in the next couple years we will see the housing shortage start to loosen up a little bit.
Yeah, I agree. I think, I mean, just the Fed raising the interest rates continuously over the last few months has already tamped down the market. The prices are still high. I still see a house, you know, for sale for $680,000 that would have gone for $240,000 about 3 years ago. So the prices are still up there, but it's, you know, it's a tough time to buy a house with high interest rates and high prices. But we're also seeing, like you said, you know, Kinnexu Land Trust with that plan, but we're also seeing private employers like Schweitzer. You know, they built they're building a worker housing project over on Triangle Drive, kind of where the old Hans Smith story
so
used to be.
It's a big apartment,
and that's encouraging to see that some of our larger employers are saying, you know what, we're taking matters into our own hands, and we're going to make sure, because it's both, you know, philanthropic. But it's also bottom line. I mean, Schweitzer's not going to have enough employees to work the ski hill.
Right. If they can't afford to live here.
They can't afford to live here. Yeah. I mean, you can't just bus in, you know, people from, you know, miles or hours and hours away. You have to have people live here when they work here. And that's the problem of many, many resort towns with ski hills across the West, is you need people to work the bars and the chairlifts and the restaurants, and you need them to have a place to live.
So the big stories, elections, growth, housing, those are probably going to continue into the next year. But let's touch base on a few stories that were kind of like one-offs. And I'll throw out one this year. We don't have to spend a lot of time talking about it. But in March, the city received a $7.5 million donation from the family of James E. Russell to build a sports center. And that construction is getting underway here shortly, I believe. It might be the largest donation to a municipality in Idaho history. Pretty remarkable.
It is.
Yeah, families that to honor their husband and dad, James E. Russell, who grew up here, born here, grew up here, was in the cohort with Pat McManus and a lot of the old timers here who are making this kind of living legacy to him. So that's a cool thing. That's being built at the at Traverse Park.
Yeah, that was a great story. And we're going to see that, you know, come to fruition here in probably late 2023 or maybe even early 2024. We might see things get finalized with that. I think another on the same city angle, I think another story that kind of caught us completely by surprise was the city of Sandpoint okaying a goose hunt at the city beach.
That just happened a few weeks ago.
You know, we were looking, Zach Hagedon, the editor, and I were looking at the agenda before. Zach covers the city council meetings, and we were just looking at the agenda, and it was just kind of in one of the agenda items, and I said, have you heard about this before? No. And so they introduced the agenda item and had already voted on it like in minutes, and there was very little discussion, and we were both kind of taken aback, like, wow, because we know the goose mitigation practices. It's been everything from, you know, coyote sculptures to agreeing to have dogs to chase the geese away to certain sprays, and They spent tens of thousands of dollars trying to get rid of the geese.
They bought a machine for $20,000 to sweep up goose poop.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, turns out, it doesn't work that great. and it really is, in my opinion, you know, if I use the city beach in the summer. I like to go there. And it kind of ruins a big chunk of the beach where goose poop all over the place. You got to watch where you're stepping, and it's got to be a health issue, right?
People, yeah, there are a lot of reasons, proponents to get rid of the goose poop. I'm kind of a live and let poop kind of guy. I don't mind the goose poop so much. I think it's a little drastic personally to kill animals because they're on your park. But you know, hey, I don't have anything against hunting as long as it's for a purpose, and people are eating the carcasses, and not just shooting for sport. I find this just one of those kind of situations that I hate to chuckle at it because it's involving the, you know, mass exodus of geese at our beach, but it's just one of those stories that kind of made us sit back and chortle.
And this one got headlines around the state.
Oh, it did, yeah.
It's like, they're a city park, they're going to have a goose hunt. It's like pretty kind of crazy. Like
only a North Idaho kind of story.
Yeah. Another story I'll throw out there for a quick comment is we got a new superintendent of schools this year, Becky Meyer. Came back. She had been the principal at Sandpoint High School for quite a number of years. She grew up here. She was Becky Kaber in those days. It was neat to see a local get hired for that. She succeeded Tom Alberson, another local, who was there. So that was kind of a big deal for our schools to get a new superintendent there.
Yeah, I think that's always great to have somebody who's well-regarded and well-known around the community, who's grown up here, who's lived here for years and years, to actually be the superintendent. We saw that with Tom, like you said. So that's a great thing. I'm always a big proponent of that. You know, try to hire local before you look outward. And she's doing a great job. It's, you know, speaking of new faces and old faces, we did have a shakeup this year with our redistricting. So, you know, Representative Heather Scott, I think she was elected 2014.
Quite a number of years she's been there now.
So she is officially no longer the representative for District 1. She was moved into District 2, and she won her primary and general election for that. So she's still in the
legislature. She wasn't even contested in District 2.
Yeah.
Which it is the very southern part of Bonner County, over near, what part of the county is it?
like Spirit Lake and
Blanchard. And then that district takes in all of the Silver Valley. So it's surprising to me that the Silver Valley didn't put a candidate up, but maybe they felt that people that might be interested in that felt like she was, already too well established as a. Usually you see somebody that is going to go for that.
Yeah. And as is her proclivity, she claimed that the redistricting personally targeted her and, obviously
there's it turns out she got a free ride into the new district. So
we said goodbye to Heather Scott as our representative. We're also saying goodbye to a couple of our commissioners, Dan McDonald and Jeff Connolly. Dan has definitely had a controversial run as commissioner. He's ruffled a lot of feathers. He's made a lot of friends. His tenure on the county has, it's covered everything from, gun rights issues and lawsuits against the city of Sandpoint for the festival at Sandpoint, no weapons policy, to very contentious land issues. So McDonald and Connolly are being replaced by another local, Luke Ahmet, and then Asia Williams, who is, and then Steve Bradshaw is staying on because he didn't run.
That's going to be an interesting story in 2023 to see how things go differently now with a couple of new faces on there. throw out another story that actually got national headlines, and that was libraries coming under fire by conservative groups that are trying to go after their collections policies. And we didn't see it as much here in Bonner County, but in Boundary County, one of our former librarians here, Kimber Glidden, came under some pretty heavy fire from the conservative group up there. She ended up resigning. And to me, the surprising thing there was they had a list of like 400 books that they want to see banned from the Boundary County Library. The library doesn't have a single one of those in its collection. Their whole beef with her was that if she told them that if somebody came in and requested them, she would ask for that book through an interlibrary loan. And a lot of these books are, they're classics even. I mean, we're talking about Animal Farm or Catch 22 or some other books that were on there that you wouldn't imagine would be on a banned books list at all. This group, I guess you could say they succeeded in their goal to get her to quit. I'm not sure what's happening up in the Boundary County Library right now, but the idea that we have groups that are trying to control what other people read is troubling to a lot of folks.
Yeah, it caused quite a stir, not only statewide, but around the country, as, many of these efforts were promoted by, more extremist outlets. The word grooming has been thrown around a lot. And it's unfortunate because I'm, as a avid reader myself, from the time I was very young, I hate the idea of limiting access to any media that children want to learn or want to learn from. I think parents should be the enforcers of that. I don't think it should be enforced by the government. Idaho, even they had House Bill 666 regarding harmful, quote unquote, library materials. It's making its way into the legislature right now. And we haven't seen the end of it. I think there's always a shiny new object that people go after. So there might be something in the future that takes attention away from this issue. But I don't think that we've seen the end of the banning books movement. And that was national news. I mean, I watched CNN interview.
She was on NPR. The national media definitely tuned into that one.
Yeah.
Well, another headline that you would put out there for the year. We only got a few minutes left now.
Yeah, I think, Reclaim Idaho pulling their ballot initiative, for the educational funding. I think that was an interesting story.
First getting it on the ballot.
Yeah.
And then the way things unfolded, you could go on.
It's interesting how it played out, because Reclaim Idaho, they've been having a lot of success with their initiatives that they start grassroots and they go from there. And this one in particular was aimed at funding education. And there's a lot of, it's very complicated, but, you know, essentially the Idaho legislature promoted their own educational funding bill, which we voted on. And that provided something like $461 million.
410, I think.
410, yeah.
And actually what Reclaim Idaho was getting to, or would have succeeded with if their initiative succeeded, was for $330 million. So mm-hmm. the state actually, after that became a ballot measure, was going to be on the ballot.
Yeah.
They came up with a even higher number, and that was from Governor Brad Little. And he called a special session, and it got approved. And after that, the Reclaim Idaho said, well, we achieved our goal, getting more funding for education, so they went ahead and withdrew their ballot measure.
Yeah, and it was a good thing. Always, you know, when you can fund education, it's a good thing. The interesting thing is that, you know, the Reclaim Idaho measure would have taken more money from the you know, top percentile of earners in Idaho, whereas this other one is does not focus on the rich. But the other caveat is that essentially the legislature next year could earmark a lot of that money out of use for education. I mean, it's not cut into stone that it has to fund education. So I think we're actually going to see a little bit of an effort to take some of that money away and redirect it to other entities and so it did fund education. It was almost a spiteful way to fund it, saying, we don't want you to do it, Reclaim Idaho. We would like to do it ourselves and have control over what we do. So yes, it's a good thing to fund education, but we're going to see that. We're going to see that the change in that.
I'm sure this next legislative session coming up starting in January, we'll definitely have that on the docket. Well, let's talk about downtown a little bit. There were some stories there. Sears Street Bridge changed hands. There's a new building going up at First and Bridge that, you know, became a point of discussion.
The Hive,
just recently, the Hive was changed hands and is starting to entertain music there again.
Yeah.
So what's your take on the downtown stories that happened this year?
The downtown stories, they just like the county, they were hits that kept hitting all year long. As we manage the growth that we're seeing over the last few years, we're going to see more and more of these stories. You know, the city is very much on a forward momentum with a lot of their projects, whether it be that land swap that they put through, which, you know,
it's kind of part of the new building at Bridge and First. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that building in itself, and just, you know, the images that developer put out there was enough to, I mean, it caused a stir. Let's just say that to be, you know, to be politic. It caused a stir throughout the town. And I think a lot of folks, they can stomach development a certain, you know, in time and place, but it stirred a lot of folks into anger when they saw it was planted right in the middle of the downtown. And that's kind of like anchoring this new idea of what Sandpoint will eventually become, which is higher buildings, luxury condos, retail on the bottom. You know, city manager Jennifer Stapleton used the term condo-ize a few weeks ago. And I thought that was very prescient, because I think that the whole idea of Sandpoint is trying to do is condo-ize a lot of things, you know, and cater to that well-to-do resident people that are moving here, either early retirement or second homes. So that right there, I mean, that kicked off a design competition downtown that the city is promoting. And I think the feedback they got off of that, off of the fear that people saw this looming condo building, you know, right downtown, was that I think a lot of residents said, we want to have a little bit more say in what's coming up. You know, even though you can't tell a developer, you can't build that because we don't like it, you can affect the comp plans and the building codes and things. And so that design competition was, I feel like, a direct result of a little bit of the feedback that we had. Mm-hmm. And so it's, as a result, I feel like Sandpoint's taking more of a hand in where it goes with development styles and everything.
And Ben, we're just about the end of our time here. It's amazing because I got a bunch of stories here that I wanted to bring up. I mean, the Bonner County Fairgrounds, there was a tragedy there with the loss of Darcy Smith, and mm-hmm. now there's questions about potential malfeasance with some of the funds there. That was a big story this year. It was a banner year for the festival at Sandpoint, so they had a record year. Schweitzer opened their new Humbird Hotel. That's, and then they announced that they're building this base camp, this new entry area that's going to really change the way you access the mountain.
Yeah.
Any others you want to mention in just a passing here before we wrap up?
I thought that group of Patriot Front members who arrested at the Coeur d'Alene Pride Parade, I know that's not Sandpoint, but that was very much national news, and that showed kind of a backlash of protesting against things like drag shows and pride parades that would just happen right in our backyard. And that one definitely got people riled up, whether they're, you know, for or against LGBTQ rights. I think that was a contentious issue. And I don't think that we're going to see the end of ideological issues that divide not only our town and county, but our country.
There's a forecast for 2023 right there.
Yeah. I don't think we're going to see the end of it for sure.
Yeah. I think if let's do a minute each of, okay, what will we see in 2023? Hey, we're going to see a ton more headlines about things having to do with growth and how, you know, we're going to handle these minor land divisions, what's going to happen with planning and zoning, the comp plans. I mean, we're experiencing so much growth that's inevitable.
Yeah. Yeah. I think statewide, I think this coming legislative period that's coming up in 2023 is going to be one that is going to have reverberations. It has skewed, you know, pretty far to the right, the whole legislature. And I think that we're going to see the introduction of a lot of bills that might get contested and challenged, just like some of the, you know, so-called anti-trans sports bills, you know, in the past. I feel like we're going to see a lot of bills introduced by a lot of
cultural issues.
Yes.
Really. Yeah.
We're going to see that leak into the state house. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know that Scott Herndon is going to go in there guns blazing, you know, figuratively. He has a lot of constitutional things that he's passionate about. So we're going to see the introduction of bills that will further divide our electorate.
I'll throw out one more that I'm interested in watching as we get into the new year here. Burlington Northern and Santa Fe opened up their new bridge across the lake. First train crossed over there on November 20th, but we're not really seeing the impact of that yet because they're working on the track that's right in front of the train station.
Yeah.
I assume that's going to get pretty well completed this year. And then are we going to see more trains, you know, coming through town? They insisted, no, it's just going to make for a better flow, but I think it's inevitable that the train traffic is going to increase here.
Yeah, I think we can sum up the entire show by saying Sandpoint is getting busy.
An astute observation, yes. Mr. Olson.
Yeah. That's what they pay me for. Yeah. Right?
All right. Well, Ben Olson with the Sandpoint Reader, thanks for being here today. And this has kind of become a little tradition here in review.
Glad to make it. Thanks for having me.